Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava. In this episode, we are diving into the transformative role of artificial intelligence in cancer care. Joining us is Dr. Sanjay Janeja, a hematologist and medical oncologist at Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center, who has also been recognized as a targeted oncology icon. Let's get started with this fascinating discussion.
Right now.
Just to kick things off, how has artificial intelligence evolved in 2024 to improve early detection of cancer, and what are its implications for community oncologists?
Yeah, so artificial intelligence has really given us reason for hope when it comes to detection earlier in cancers, which obviously the hope is that they get cured, you know, quicker, I guess. There's several examples. One is where they were looking at pancreatic cancer. That's pretty exciting. It was, I think, Northwell Health. And using kind of AI-powered technology with MRI and CT scans, what you can do is you can appreciate changes that may be really challenging to notice with the naked eye, right? Just some pixelated changes or things that are happening in the architecture. We're talking about subtleties so small that it takes something like, you know, artificial intelligence kind of powering to compare a whole bunch of things that happened in the past, and then knowing that they turned out to be cancer. That's what primes this AI technology to say, yo, I've seen that before, and I know that X amount of time it actually turns into invasive pancreatic cancer and is able to clue you in sooner. And I think that's the concept behind AI excitement, especially when it relates to imaging, because a lot of times, if you think about it, radiologists don't always get the benefit of seeing a serial number of radiology images and comparing them, knowing kind of at the top of mind that they're all the same patient. They may pull up a previous scan, but that gets very exciting. There's all kinds of imaging that AI is helping to notice these things, especially with breast cancer. There's also technology that's coming out to be able to increase both the sensitivity, so how easily or quickly you can appreciate something while scanning the or doing a mammogram or screening for breast cancer, but also the specificity. So a lot of these kind of false positives or concerns where we end up doing invasive procedures, causes a lot of stress and anxiety, those can really be reduced by having better imaging techniques. And then there's a whole bunch of other examples when it comes to AI imaging. And then there's also what I get really excited about is AI's application when it comes to a multimodality concept. So what that means is, you know, right now we go by very straightforward things like this is your age and you're a female or male, and so we're going to, you know, do something at these certain intervals. But where I also get really excited is this multimodality approach, where instead of having these kind of hard set like male, female, you know, this is your age, having AI's understanding, remember, it's just prediction. When you feed AI longitudinal data, like these are all the variables, these are all the metrics, this is what ended up happening to people by the thousands, like hundreds of thousands. And then you can kind of ascertain what characteristics may be at higher risk. And when you say multimodal, you know, that means you consider their molecular stuff, if it's precancerous, or even if it's like germline, meaning like the stuff you were inherited with. And then you might think, okay, how much does metabolic syndrome matter? How much does A1C matter? How much, you know, any of these things that you could conceive, they can help really delineate what is the risk factor for an individual rather than a person of a certain age. And that's super exciting. Again, takes a multimodality approach, but then also you have all these kind of tests coming out that are able to, you know, check for pre-cancer mutations at a very, what's called low sensitivity. I mean, a high sensitivity, meaning before you could even potentially see it on an image, you may be able to tell that there's some precancerous lesions that are classic to say cervical cancer or colon cancer or even early cancer itself. Now, a lot of people say, well, how would you know where it is and what do you do with it? But that's when you can look at, you know, things called theranostics, to where you could actually inject things that say are metabolized that are fuel sources for rapidly growing tumors. it's kind of like a PET scan, but you're checking based on metabolic activity of something else other than glucose. So those things are getting much more, defined and earlier as well. And then another one is like also with endoscopies. So if you think about it, you know, you're putting a camera down to check for like an upper scope, for example. Well, when you have AI technology embedded, it can consider all of the things that maybe you don't have as a gastroenterologist in your local area. Like if you happen to have one, you know, Indian patient or of Indian descent or Jamaican descent, and they have certain turmeric based diets, then suddenly what you're looking for and the idiosyncrasies about that very early, you know, polyp lesion, you know, may not be top of mind. But now they have technologies where you input those variables and it can kind of pull up all of the things that are more unique or classic about that person with a turmeric or curry-based diet, or, you know, what medications they're on, or what may be, you know, those idiosyncrasies for them specifically. And it can kind of just flag on the screen like, hey, you know, I know we went by this, but there's something that's XYZ, you know, beta zeta that is relevant to maybe having a little higher degree of concern. So that's where you're able to detect polyps at a higher rate as well. And that can go both from upper and lower scopes. So these are all things that do not replace, you know, physicians by any means or some of our diagnostic tests, but certainly leverage and kind of, you know, maybe one day add a log, like actually just logarithmically help the utility or use case for these, imaging and molecular or blood-based screenings that we do.
That's excellent. That's a really great answer. Thank you so much for those insights. And I guess specifically on the treatment side, could you share some examples on how AI has been used to tailor treatments to individual patients more effectively?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things when it comes to treatments that, you know, you do the best you can, and the best you can may mean whatever that population was of the study where the data came out. It may not be representative to a high degree of minorities or people that like had other comorbids or medications, or a big one, in my opinion, pharmacogenomics, like what does their metabolism look like? Those things aren't just able to be considered. The studies would never get complete if you had to just, you know, partition down by all of these different things. So you do what the data shows you, even though your specific patient may not even have one person that's exactly like them on the trial. So you could imagine when AI is able to longitudinally collect and see what happens to the people that, you know, have certain pharmacogenomics that are different, or have certain diets that are different, or are on metformin or statin. One day, at least with machine learning, you could say, hey, something is different on this, you know, axis or tangent. So I get very excited about that. And then also with treatments, it's very exciting that we are able to really get even another tool to be able to see how effective immune therapy could be in a certain setting. Because first we started with PD-1, PD-L1, right? And then we went to, you know, tumor mutational burden and CPS. So we were getting arguably better, or at least having different ways that someone could qualify for something that's generally not that toxic. Now, and since then, we've really learned that immune therapy is not just something that's expressed on the tumor cell. It also matters what's in the microenvironment and what's on the cells that are in the actual tumor area that aren't actually tumor cells. And then also what are in your immune cells. So you have all these different factors that a lot of people may be missing a potentially really good response potentially to immune therapy because of just the things we have. Well, now AI has been really amazing on getting tissue samples and assessing with a predictive score on how likely you are to respond or not respond. Because another problem that I say causes oncologists like moral injury is when there's a bad outcome, right? And so say in lung cancer, you know, we're doing neoadjuvant more, and a lot of times it involves immune therapy. But if somebody's on the fence with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, you don't want them to lose the benefit, but at the same time, you know, you could really harm them. So if you have an extra AI enabled tool to say, you know, the benefit just may not be that high here, now you avoid the toxicities of bringing back lupus or getting debilitating rheumatoid arthritis. So in that way, it helps the patient and the physician between decisions. And then, you know, a third example, and Tempus has an example of this, is some of the confusion where we're like, we know that didn't why it didn't, sorry, we know that it should have worked and it didn't, we as an oncologist, then you can start to understand why. And in this specific example, they use digital pathology, which means that you take the slide and you scan it into the computer to use a multimodality approach. So they were also looking for the molecular targets on the blood. Well, the molecular targets on the blood or on the report said it was HER2 positive breast cancer and it was stage four. Well, it turned out that, it turned out that the HER2 positive part, which was very positive, was only in situ, meaning it had never actually been invasive cancer. So the invasive cancer was triple negative. But if you treat with HER2 therapy, dual HER2 therapy and potential heart failure and all this stuff for something that's actually not the thing that's causing the stage four cancer, you know, you're in trouble. And you can see how easily that would happen. This digital pathology was able to recognize that the HER2 positivity did not apply to the tissue outside of the body. And, you know, it kind of saves us again from that moral injury of, you know, I don't know why you didn't respond. You know, you were so positive on your HER2 testing. I'm sorry you didn't respond to dual. That's a huge, you know, wind knocked out of the sails for a family and a patient. And then it also hurts for the doctor. Same with like a small cell that doesn't respond to platinum therapy. You get all excited, but 15% don't, you know, or 10%, and then EGFR positivity. So how do we figure all of these things out? That's what AI, I think, will help us to where we can bump an 85% to 95% because of some variables we don't really think about.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer. And it kind of ties into my next question. So if you want to skip this one, just let me know. But how can AI tools help community oncologists with decision making or managing the increasing complexity of cancer care?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of, you know, there are a bunch of things coming out that are like code decision support. And a lot of people kind of get like, whoa, I don't need help with my decisions, et cetera. I kind of explain it as it's not like we're going to do the job for you and figure it out, but it's just going to quickly knock off the weeds, like how a house sometimes is overgrown if you buy it, if it's been neglected, and then you have to just hack away everything away. And then you can kind of prune and you know, do the little delicacies. Code decision support may just knock off, like really dust off the tires, or the weeds, so that you can then use the idiosyncrasies in your final decision making. But at least as things get really complex and we have these, you know, tissue agnostic markers that are coming out with RET and NTRK and MSI high, and until our data is more easily retrievable, like if you're a non-Epic user, it becomes challenging because you're still on PDFs. There's just so much room for ball drops and human fallibility to affect the major outcome on a patient or their families. That's where I think AI can assist, just to say like, hey, you know, I know you've been seeing Miss Betty for 3 years, you know, or 4 years, for example, with stage four hormone positive cancer. You may just not realize that ESR1 data came out after they progressed on hormone therapy the first time. And so you've been seeing them for 2.5 years and you're just, you know them, you think like, okay, what's the next? But a little flag that says, hey, by the way, ESR1 testing wasn't around at that time. You were like, oh, great. Like now I can think about it. That's where I think it'll really help. It's kind of that, you know, that aha passive moment or reminder that could be helpful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you for adding that part of it. And I guess just looking at some of the challenges, what would you say are the biggest challenges oncologists face when trying to integrate AI into their practice?
I think first and foremost, it's a little bit of the unknown, right? And I think that's a very important one because you don't want to use something to fail fast if it has a lot of potential, if it was done only from not being very comprehensive and doing due diligence. So I do think that's one of the biggest concerns, and rightfully so. There are unanswered questions on like, well, what about inherent bias, for example? Like, how do I know that it's not basically perpetuating biases that we know existed before when it came to outcomes and trials and certain demographics that were receiving therapy? Number two, it's like, what is it going to do with this? You know, that's another thought. And then outside of that, a big concern is really the new and just evolving germinal legalities and technicalities when it comes to governance. When it comes to de-identification, de-identification is not binary. There's quality of de-identification that's more of a spectrum. And then, the connection, the data point, like how do you actually like plug in, quote unquote? And then on top of that, the complexity of is the data even kind of organized or structured or framed in a way that the AI can even do what it's supposed to do? Like, how do you know what it's not getting, right? Because we don't really have a good standardization on how data should be exchanged and stored. And that's where I get really excited about something called TEFCA, where TEFCA is finally basically the federal government's way of saying, okay, we need some kind of standardization. We're not going to be the ones that are just going to say everyone has to do it our way. But they picked like five or six QHINs that help ensure good utility from health information exchanges. So if that sounds like a bunch of jargon, health information exchanges basically are is kind of like think of it like a cloud that is storing the data for things, but it can be messy and disorganized, and you may not know what's in there. And now QHINs kind of offer this way of saying like, hey, it's actually a file cabinet where I kind of know, okay, this is imaging, this is reports, this is pathology, and I kind of have an idea of how and what is where. And then having that file cabinet, now you can introduce the natural language processing, which is behind the AI products and tools, and then the LLMs, quote unquote, to be able to have qualitative meaning behind it and express it back to you. So for that process to happen on making sure that it's analyzing it properly and effectively and communicating it back well, all depends on how digestible is the data by which it's starting the entire process. So I think those are a couple of, big challenges. And another one is, I think people just don't want to share data because they're like, I know this is valuable somehow, so I'm going to hold off. But then that holding off means saving those potential ball drops in those patients with AI assistance. Like you're just kind of putting it on pause. And I think that causes me a lot of distress. So there's a lot of challenges there. And, Deborah Pat is a good friend of mine and mentor. She's the chairperson for ASCO's AI task force. I know they're just working so diligently on trying to help us navigate those things.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Perfect. Thank you. And obviously, there's ongoing concern sometimes about biases in AI algorithms. So, how do you think we can ensure equitable care when using these tools in oncology?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very big thing. And so, one thing that people may not know is that you can prompt. I think prompt engineering is overly intimidating as a phrase. It just means like do a really good job of giving contextual, giving context to what you want. That's all prompt engineering is. So if you're concerned about that, then I might specify, hey, I'm in an area where there's more, Black Americans and diabetics and overweight individuals than I'm talking about maybe Southern Louisiana, somewhere that's, underserved, than the rest of the country. Please consider this when it relates to what you are bringing back and consider any possible and potential inherent biases that may be perpetuated due to inadequate representation on the trials and the data that you're about to present. Take your time doing this process. And please highlight anything that may be a deviation from what your answer is going to be at reflex due to these considerations. Now, you can actually teach AI to screen and consider biases for things that came out after what the initial trial was. So that's very important. And I think the second piece of that, which we're not there yet, is using machine learning to really, and AI just in general, to meaning data science being like AI being a part of data science, now we can actually kind of earmark what happens to individuals of those different, like maybe racial backgrounds or socioeconomic, and see where the deviations are in real world data to then maybe give us better insight on going back and saying, hey, we need to like find a different trial or better guidelines or consider having an exception for this subgroup. Like, because no one does a good job. We can't. It's too high volume of really seeing what happens with real world data over time. That's why you need, neuronal networks. That's why you need this entire concept of tensors with AI to be able to process computationally so many different layers and depths so quickly to really appreciate what is actually happening to people with different heterogeneous backgrounds. And that's where I get very excited because I can maybe potentially unravel the biases finally, by being able to say, yo, this is why, Black Americans do worse in first line treatment for, prostate cancer, or that we say it's more aggressive or it's less diagnosed, in breast cancer, all these things that we keep seeing. The question is why? And if we can get more details, not on why even, but just something that's observational, then it can help us explain the why quicker.
Yeah, that's a really, really great answer. Very good to add. So thank you for that. And I guess moving into precision medicine a little bit now, what are the most significant developments in biomarker discovery or testing in 2024, and how might they benefit patients in community oncology settings?
Yeah, I think we're getting very kind of good and almost to the point of maybe saturated when it comes to actually having genomic data. So I was at Advancing Precision Medicine APM in Philadelphia, and there were so many speakers were talking about the depth and comprehensiveness of molecular testing, right? And where I get excited is, we can check somatic mutations, like, on the tumor. We were testing a lot of DNA at first, and then we've started to learn, hey, RNA matters also, because at the end of the day, what is being transcribed, is very pertinent and valuable. And if you're not checking RNA in addition to DNA, we know you can miss potential targets. So that was, rather big on being able to realize that that's important. We're also able to understand better what some of the germline properties do in relation to that somatic process, meaning, like, the tumors, like qualities, RNA and DNA both. And then I got excited about a conversation I had with a gentleman at Stanford on my podcast about truncal mutations. Can we actually even engineer vaccines or other therapies that try to remove or hack down, like, the trunk of the tree rather than the branches, where, like, if you have a very downstream mutation, you have a target for it. Okay, great. It makes another branch. That's something a little different. Can you get, more truncal? And I think AI helps, that piece of it a lot. And then, of course, when you're talking about that immune therapy, score, because now that's based on the patient's specific tumor, right? You're getting a biopsy of the tumor and the environment is the patient's specific cells and the distribution of their immune cells. You could see how precise that is, because now it's less about just staining a protein, but you're looking at everything that's about the patient themselves. That can really help guide precision therapy in the sense of what to do with the treatment. And then, we know that there's, like, 1 to 3% of the time that kind of last line in a stage four setting, some targeted therapies, oral agents work, and we just don't know why. And so there are companies, like, I think Travera's one, and there's someone that does it similarly, the name escapes me, where they take the tissue and actually apply different chemotherapies in vivo, sorry, in vitro, but with the tissue itself, and then they use different AI analyzers to see what is sensitive and what is not. They do it in all different kind of ways. One, checking to see how quickly the cell crenates or loses its mass in over 4 hours. And we know that these tissues die at a rate in 4 hours as it is, but then if you could see if it dies quicker after the application of drug, then the thought is, okay, maybe it's sensitive to something about the drug. So, like, that, there you go, precision therapy at its finest, because you're actually getting to test on in the test tube, and there's multiple companies doing this. So instead of doing that 4 to 6 weeks, I mean, let's be real, 6 to 8 weeks often before you can even do the first scan to see if somebody is responding, mind you, receiving, dangerous agents. Imagine if you knew in 4 hours and didn't have to put it in their vein and throughout their body and make them do that for 2 months. I mean, that's where we're headed. Like, it's and it's happening, like, on these, with these startups and small companies. So I believe, at some point, ideally, and I know this sounds bold, but where it won't matter as much the histopathology of, like, adenocarcinoma and squamous, and it's just routine when it becomes affordable enough to just test on tissue itself. And so you get your treatment plan just for the cancer, whatever the cancer is, like, because we know that there's so many serendipities and idiosyncrasies on something behaving. This is not behaving like most pancreatic, most lung. Like, if you think about the impact of that statement, the emotional impact, I mean, how hard is that to hear as a patient and a family? It's like, It's like on top of you having cancer, it's like yours isn't even behaving for cancer. Like it's just so sad. And like I think that's where this concept of precision therapy and testing on the actual tumor and your blood and your all those same properties can really change the way that people are guided through these processes.
Yeah, that's awesome. And right off of that, just obviously, like since genomic and molecular profiling are becoming such critical parts of precision medicine, I know access can be limited in some areas. So what are there any steps being taken to kind of access those advances?
Yeah, so that's a great question and concern. And a lot of people are doing obviously mobile phlebotomies. There's tests that you can even order that can be saliva based. But I'll tell you one answer that I think most people don't think about or would get excited about. Because to your point, if it's hard to get molecular testing and it's a blood sample and you have to collect it and do it right, et cetera, AI is now assisting you. Recognition of actionable mutations or biomarkers just on the PET scan, meaning you get the PET scan and it can tell you there's a high probability they're EGFR positive or LAG3 positive, just by assessing the image itself. So now you have reduced the time that it takes from that PET scan to saying, oh, it's hot, let's refer to the medical oncologist seeing it, getting a blood sample, I mean, molecular on the tissue and the blood, waiting 3 weeks for the results to come. Then you are EGFR positive. Now you're already 5, 6 weeks out. Now we'll put in the prior authorization and call in the drug. So you're starting something 7 to 8 weeks later. Then if one day it's validated that we can say with certainty what these actionable biomarkers are on the image, now suddenly that issue of both time duration, time to treatment, but also the molecular testing, which can be costly even though it's getting much better, can reduce that because it's you're finding these things out on imaging. Otherwise, I think people are have been very good about the mobile component, and I'm interested to see where things go with I don't know if it's mail-in and how we can assess those things otherwise. But to your point, outside of imaging, I can't think of another way to appreciate the molecular patterns without actually getting sample.
That's so cool. Yeah, I didn't know all the intricacies behind that. So that's excellent. Thank you for highlighting that. And in overall, what trends or developments in AI and precision medicine do you foresee having the greatest impact on community oncology practices in the next, let's say, like 3 to 5 years, I guess?
Oh boy. I think, it's not like, jazzy kind of fun stuff, but there is a very real problem with burnout and overwhelmment because like the death by 1,000 paper cuts, or I had a physician tell me last week when I was speaking in Chicago that it's death by 1,000 clicks now. But whatever it is, it's like it's getting so big that the burnout, I believe, was like up to 48% this past year. The AMA, I believe it was the AMA that polled, 48% of oncologists expressed some degree of burnout. And I think a lot of that is the 1,000 clicks, 1,000 paper cuts, what have you, and frustrations with like prior auth and just like things that are unjust. So that is an immediate, a more immediate solution that AI can bring because these ambient learning devices are becoming very good at truly transcribing not just the note and being a transcription thing, but even putting in the diagnosis codes based on the language so that I don't have to go find them. And sometimes they're just so weird that takes a while. If I don't do it right or I didn't do it right, and then I do the drug, then they come back and they say there's a delay because this is not the right code. And then I have to go back to the code, even though it's been 2 days since I've seen them. Like it's ridiculous. And this happens every day, all the time. So if you have something that's listening and building the right codes and then populating, Tempus is doing what's called Shepherd or patient prior authing, where it's just like the prior auth is assembled by AI. These are all time reductions in time. And now they're also doing like a generative AI where you can even ask, you can, ask questions about findings. And I think other people are looking into that as well. I think Epic is and Intata on, can we have a generative AI, which instead of me doing the filter for pathology, radiology, where was that report? What did it say? AI is reading it, and you can actually just say, hey, when was the last molecular and what was the positive findings? And that just like ChatGPT tells you that because it's able to actually access and read the data. So in this way, things I think really reduce how often they're being or falling through the cracks. That's huge. How much fulfillment comes from the good parts and aspects of oncology practice rather than the laborious and truly inconsequential, but just formality and necessary stuff. And then after that wave, I think what's coming is, or what's already here actually, is AI assistance with trials, because we can't get better on drugs and treatments when people on social media are like, how come we haven't figured it out? Why are things so slow? It's valid. I mean, we can't approve anything. Not a single treatment is without a trial. And it takes literally years from start to finish to get an approval based on a trial. But recruitment is a part of that process. So if you can plug and play and do it, play, not to mean it, reductively or reduces significance of it, but if you can do that for tailored demographics that you want to learn more, we know that are badly represented or poorly represented, now you have faster progress because you have faster insights for quicker indications. That one's huge. And then I think the third one is the multimodality approach, where instead of relying on a single pathologist, a single medical oncologist, which is me, a single radiologist, having some kind of background learning that puts it all together. And that's called a multimodal platform, to where it can consider the digital pathology and the invasive part and not the invasive part, and the radiology and what happened in the past, really whack away a lot of those overgrown weeds that's so hard to just muscle through that you're doing all the time when it comes to a challenging access data world, as well as lack of clarity on what to do about specific things for a specific individual. All that to say, I think we'll be treating more precisely in a way we don't even think about now. Everyone thinks about precision as in the molecular characteristics of the tumor. Like, no, it's like precision is considering all of the imaging stuff, the drugs they're on, pharmacogenomics, like, and then having it like in front of you and making a true customized treatment plan. Like, that's in, I believe that's very conceivable, like at the 5-year mark from today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And I think you really hit on all of the key points that I was hoping to highlight, but is there anything that I didn't ask that you wish I did or anything that you want to add?
I would add another thing that I get excited about is wearable data, because right now, like, we do like toxicity checks after chemo, right? It's just if it's a 3-week chemo, ideally you bring them in a week after. And I would say most of them are fine. Like, their labs are fine. They feel fine, especially if it's, first or second cycle. But you do everyone because you don't want to miss the one that's not fine and the one that, gets very neutropenic or has colitis. Wearables is one way of being able to really tell or triage, in the future when someone may need to come in or not. Because they've looked at AI processing for even Apple Watches. When it's in the background calculating the heart rate and your respiratory rate and your dilation of your skin, it can alert people, well before respiratory failure when it comes to COVID and flu pneumonitis. Like, yo, that same flight of stairs that you climb every morning to work, it's making you short of breath more than usual. But it's not so bad that I'm like actually, satting 80%. So it's a much earlier tip-off to then get the antibodies for COVID or flu. You can imagine what that would do for immune therapy and HER2 targeted agents and a lot of these things that cause pneumonitis, because we're just taking a shot in the dark. One moment, like, they come in, get the labs at that 1 second, a week after between 3-week treatments, and that's it. And then they come in the next time. Like, and that's crazy. But what if you were able to triage the ones that on their Apple Watch, literally the heart rate is just going up consistently. So maybe an early PE, right? Pulmonary embolism, or that the, these oral agents can cause really high blood pressure, that something's going on with that. Now, all of a sudden, instead of this one picture at a moment in time, you have this continuous data, longitudinal data that can help to guide care. And some people say, oh, well, that's just another thing a doctor worry about. I'm like, no, it's what it is clarity on the things that you should that you're worrying about on everyone, on hopefully fewer, because you have the peace of mind for a lot of them that you don't. And I think in that way, again, the quality of time gets improved.
For more updates on the latest news and trends in oncology, be sure to visit www.targetedonc.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. You can also find us across social media platforms. Follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Targeted Onc, and on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Targeted Oncology. See you next time.